Pirate RC, and I'm up in the Village in New York City with Meg Hutchinson, who just finished a performance of the Rockwood. How you doing, Meg?
Good. Psyched to be here at this moment in the evening.
Yeah, we've had a long afternoon, so the hardships of touring, I guess, is like driving through major traffic. And
yeah, I mean, this is an unusual day with, we had, you know, the Pride Parade right in the middle of New York, and so that created a few traffic issues, to put it mildly, but... Yeah. Hey, we got to the gig, and Jeremy's sister was there, exactly, so yes. Made my night.
Yeah, it was kind of like a mini get him to the Greek kind of thing at the end of it, right?
Yeah.
We're just like, all right, are we going to get Meg to the Rockwood?
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Yeah, we're like counting down. 2 minutes left, but it's great.
It was cool, and it was a solid performance, I think. I mean, just from like my perspective as a fan. So,
it felt good. Sometimes like the sheer adrenaline of not being able to get there, and then you get on stage, and you're like, oh, this is the part I love. Like, all the logistics, all the travel can be really hard, but the minute I'm on the stage, that's what I love to do. So it comes usually at pull through in that moment. I'm like, this is worth it.
So, well, one thing, when you introduced Gatekeeper,
yeah,
you told a story at the beginning that, if you don't mind just telling it to Anne, because it actually elicited applause from a couple of people. It just kind of, I think, changed the meaning of the song for someone who listens to it now knowing the story. So what inspired you to write that song?
So I read an article in the New Yorker a number of years ago about the Golden Gate Bridge and what a destination it is for suicide jumpers. And they interviewed a guy named Kevin Briggs, who's a patrolman there, and he had saved 200 people. And they asked him how, and he said that he asked them two questions: how are you feeling, and what are your plans for tomorrow? And they seem like such bold questions because they're such ordinary questions, mm-hmm. you know, like the things that people are actually afraid to ask them in an emergency situation, but that those are the things that could save that many people. It was a real wake-up call to me that, you know, we need to look around us and ask those questions on a daily basis.
With your toes upon the edge, with your eyes upon the sky, tell me just these things before you fly.
The notion of tomorrow for someone who's thinking they won't have one is probably, like, you know, a major thing. Someone cares what they're doing the next day, then that probably changes the whole entire thing.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm sure he continues that with, well, let me, you know, come with me and I'll give you something to do tomorrow. And if you do that and then you come back to the bridge after that, I'll let you jump. You know, and that's kind of his deal. And they never do. And I think that's one of the big things, is that if people can get through that crisis period, like 90% of them will go on to live a full life. You know, it's just that moment in which they need to be stopped. And the few people that have survived the fall say that the minute they let go of the railing, they knew everything was fixable in their lives if they could just get back on that bridge and have another shot. So,
yeah, really, I actually read an article today in the New York Times about this interior designer who committed suicide, and no one really understands why.
Hmm.
Like, him and his partner were planning it up to kid and everything, and they're saying I don't know, it was just this weird story, just reading, like, you know, and probably some of those people, like, no one would know why. Like, they would probably have no idea.
I mean, and there's also a huge correlation between mental illness and suicide, and that's an issue that I, think about a lot and write about a lot, and, mm-hmm. and I think, you know, it can create a chemical crisis situation in which, you know, someone makes a snap decision like that, and with the right treatment and the right care, they can never have to go to that place again.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's really something that I feel like this record, the Living Side record, is, it's really, you know, dealing with that topic from a lot of different issues,
mm-hmm.
a lot of different sides.
So just in listening to it as, like, an entire body, which I kind of think is important with this album, and some albums are, you know, like 12 individual songs or whatever. This one seemed kind of like a lot of them were interlocked. Is that fair to say?
I mean, oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I like a record that feels like chapters from the same mm-hmm. novel. You know, they're a family of songs, and they all kind of speak to each other. And the hope is that you produce them in a way that isn't monotonous, the way that gives them each their own kind of color on the record. But, yeah, they're definitely dealing with a couple themes.
So kind of going maybe on the flip side, maybe just, and I could be drawing a parallel that's not there, so just let me know, with being happy.
Yeah.
That's one that struck me, and just kind of the line, what's wrong with being happy,
What's the harm in
being happy?
Yeah.
Yes. Just where did that song come from?
Well, you know, I don't quite believe this idea that we have to be tortured in order to create good art. You know, we see it throughout history, and sadly, again, that's a product of a lot of mental illness going hand in hand with creativity, and there's no denying that pattern appears a lot. But I don't believe that you have to destroy your life in order to make good art, and I, you know, in that song, I'm really kind of talking about, referring to this William Butler Yeats poem, The Choice, where he's talking about, you know, to choose a life or to choose the art, and he's talking about, you know, you have to only choose one, and I'm disagreeing and saying, well, wait a minute, I think you can choose both. I think you can have a life that doesn't kill you, and I think you can still make vivid, visceral art, and you have a much longer period of time to work if you're not completely destroying yourself.
Madness sings a siren song, the sea calls me but I don't swim on. Let the old year be behind me, let the old year be behind me, let the old year be behind me. What's the harm in being happy?
What's Is there something that just continuously makes you happy?
Yeah, I mean, I guess when my work is actually helping to transform an emotion in my life rather than being a place that I'm stuck. But if it's a way, if being creative is a way to transform the darker emotions in my life and kind of write myself a map out of them, then I'm pretty happy. You know, that really sends me when I feel like it's working.
One thing that just I noticed in and reading up on you is like David Gray's an influence. I can hear that definitely. And he kind of, with his lyrics, you may not realize that they're making you feel good, but they are. And I kind of found that with listening to you and just in thinking about David Gray or other influences. What do you get out of, like, from him or from those people?
You know, some of my favorite David Gray work is actually his earlier records, like the record Flesh. I don't know if you know that album, but I think that's one of the best writing, just best records I've ever heard. Well, I just think he's genuinely a really great wordsmith on top of being a pop songwriter, like having really good hooks, but it comes from a deeper place.
Right.
And there's something in his voice that is really true. It's really honest. Doesn't feel like he's putting it on. And melodically, I really love what he does, too. But, yeah, it's vibey, and I think that's one of the things that more and more I'm carving out what the vibe is for me in my records, you know, especially the Living Side, which is kind of cinematic and like, this kind of moody, vibey space. So I got that a lot from, like, White Ladder, you know, has that almost dreamscape to it, you know, and I thought about that a lot. So, yeah, I just have a lot of respect for him, and you know, it's great to see someone who's really good succeed to that level,
for sure.
You know.
Well, and he tells stories, too, in which you do. And I think that's kind of cool to be able to take maybe... Well, you look at The New Yorker, for example, right? And a lot of the authors in there are taking what would generally be like a news story.
Yeah.
And just making it this beautiful nonfiction work. And then you're kind of like just going back to the example of Gatekeeper, taking that and making it into a song, and just a totally different type of narrative. And I don't know, that's pretty cool. And do you like to tell stories? I mean, and you write poetry too, right? I mean, that's...
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like, for me, it has to start with a personal connection to it, but I don't feel like, even though my songs are really intimate, I don't feel like they're necessarily all about me. Mm-hmm. You know, especially on this record, I feel like the lens really opened and suddenly there was a much bigger kind of scope to what I was looking at, but still through my own experience, you know. I don't feel like I can just intellectually tackle a subject like the war or, you know, instead it comes in the form of like a dream, like Travel In, you know, seeing a boy running towards a checkpoint with a white flag in his hand, which was a real dream I had, and then I'm like, that's how I feel about the war, you know.
Yeah, just being able to express specialists think differently. So what's songwriting like for you, like the process?
You know, it's still kind of half a mystery to me, but what I do think about all the time is language and words and images. And I feel like I'm collecting little pieces before I know what they're part of. You know, and writing, I do write in a journal and try to keep it with me all the time. But I'm collecting stuff before I know what song it belongs in. Mm-hmm. And then when I start to feel like an idea coming together, and usually, like for me, it's two ideas that I know are connected. I know that they both belong in the song and I don't know how, and then it's a matter of filling in the space between yeah. them. And that's when these other images start to take on a metaphoric quality, and then I'm like, I go gathering through my notebook, and I'm like, oh, you're a tasty one, like, you belong in there. And then I start to realize, oh, this is why these things have resonated, because I've been subconsciously looking for this song. You mm-hmm. know, there's a lot of work that goes on under the surface that then kind of once the cover's pulled off it, I go, oh, yeah, I've been working on this for 3 weeks, and I didn't even know it. So there's some of that blind faith, and then there's also some of, like, paying attention, being awake, like, noticing when the things strike me as they go by and capturing them.
Do you remember when you first started writing, like, when you first decided, like, that you could sing and songwriting was a possibility, or was it not even a decision? Maybe it's just something.
It kind of evolved naturally, but I went to a Waldorf school as a kid, kind of a holistic alternative school, and there's a lot of music in it, so I mm-hmm. sang kind of on a daily basis. But then in eighth grade, I had to do a special project, and I decided to write a song about South Africa for this geography class. And then I got to play it at the talent show, and I remember, like, bursting out into tears after the show.
Yeah.
And everyone was like, why are you crying? That was really good. Why are you crying? And I was crying because I was so happy, because I knew what I loved. Like, in that moment, I was like, that's what I want to do. And as a little eighth grader, like, I went marching out, and I remember there was a snowstorm, and I went walking out with my guitar case thinking, I'm going to be carrying this thing around for a long time. And then I went down to a local open mic that week,
as an eighth grader.
And I was like, I have one song, can I play it? And then there was kind of, you know, then my teens hit, and I just kind of lost. You know how that happens. I lost a few years, but then my late teens, I really started to focus on it.
And was music in your home, too? Was it?
Yeah, lots of, I mean, old hippie parents, so lots of records, you know, a lot of good music playing that I didn't think was cool for a lot of years, but then I was like, oh, that's pretty good conditioning, you know, not bad.
Do you remember the first album you bought, or first song, maybe, that you...
You know, I remember the first ones that were given to me.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
There was a Mimi and Richard Farina record that I loved, and there's a song on there, Pack Up Your Sorrows.
Okay.
And it's a song that, you know, if somehow you could pack up your sorrows and give them all to me, you would lose them, I know how to use them, give them all to me. And I was like, that's what I want to do. It seemed like such a great idea that people could give you their sadness and you could make music with it, and mm-hmm. then put it out there and use it. Like, how do you use the sadness? And so I loved that record, and then my dad gave me an early Joni Mitchell record.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking her voice was kind of odd, but I thought she was pretty cool.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was given to me. I can't remember what I bought first, but I love Greg Brown. He's on kind of the founding artist on Red House Records. It's my label. And so I probably bought his early records pretty young. Yeah. Sean Colvin, Steady On.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I'm so excited to open for her in a few weeks. Cause she really struck a nerve in me as a kid, like, this is a chick who's going to talk about her emotions, you know, and do it with, like, in a ballsy way and be a really good musician. And she really inspired me.
So musically, as far as learning the guitar, how did you come about doing that? Is it something you taught yourself, or a combination of lessons? And
it's funny, I think the guitar playing has been the afterthought. Like, I've been doing it all along, but it hasn't been the focus.
Mm-hmm.
When I was 10, my grandmother passed away, and I inherited her Martin guitar.
Oh, wow.
Her 57 Martin, and I'd only been taking lessons for like maybe half a year, but I had flown out to visit her that year, and I'd sung songs with her, and I think she decided, you know, you're going to be a musician.
Wow.
So to get her guitar, I was like, okay, wow, this is serious.
Now it's kind of a responsibility.
It was a huge responsibility. I was kind of terrified of it for a year. Like, I actually was terrified to touch the guitar, because it felt like it was her, you know, now that she'd passed away. Like,
yeah.
You know, and I always feel like there are songs living in that guitar that she didn't get to write. you know, that I I feel they're there, and I'm still trying to figure out which ones to write of those songs. But.
And what do you, what did you play tonight? What are you playing on the road?
It's a kind of a cheaper Martin. You know, Martins are still great, and I actually, I bought it in New York. I bought it on Bleecker Street maybe 14 years ago on the way to the old living room.
That's kind of cool. Just to...
I remember being late to get to the gig because I found the guitar I wanted, and then I was running through the village, like, with a guitar in each hand, you know, like, barely getting to the gig in time. I think I made up some story about getting stuck, which I feel bad about.
Stuck behind a pride parade.
Yeah, at least today.
Yeah, maybe that was, like, the karma that came back to you.
Yeah, I think it was. Today I deserved it. Yeah, think you're
Bleecker
right.
Street.
Yeah, totally. But, man, it was worth it, because that guitar, I've only had it worked on once in 14 years, and it's been beat up, totally beat up, and, it, you know, it's functional.
One song you sang tonight, I think it was called Seeing Stars.
Yeah.
Yeah, and do you just want to talk about a little bit about maybe your dog and just kind of how that was a different kind of karma, maybe? Like, maybe
that was really cool.
Done something on time, and...
I was like, I still get chills talking about it because it was so, like, the timing of it was so beautiful. So I wrote Seeing Stars about 3 years ago, walking around a reservoir where I hike with a dog every day. And it just hit me. I don't know where it came from. It was one of those rare songs you're not trying to write. Mm-hmm. Ran to the car, wrote it on a map.
Wow.
Went home, heard the music in my head, went home, played it, recorded it for myself, and then... it went on the record Come Up Full, my previous record, which came out in 2008. And I guess somebody was playing it on satellite radio for a whole year, but I didn't know that. And in 2009, when we found out she had pretty bad cancer, and I'm saying she because she's lying on her feet right now.
Yeah, she's like right here.
But she had pretty bad cancer and needed a big surgery. And the morning that we were going to the vet for that surgery, the check arrived. The mailman was standing there when I opened the door, and it was $1,600 from... royalties for that song.
That's crazy.
Paid for her whole surgery, and then the royalties keep coming in from that song. Like, for some reason, that's the one that's been adopted by radio, and so it's paid for her care, and she's totally awesome. Like, a year and a half later, I mean, she's still, the cancer came back, but you'd never know. And so that's just been kind of our little miracle worker song.
Yeah.
Pretty fun.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy. Well, one thing I like to ask besides the first record is, do you remember the first live show you went to?
First big one. I saw Tracy Chapman and I saw Sean Colvin in Great Barrington when I was pretty young. And those were both amazing shows. One of the shows that really moved me, and I was older, this was more like 16, I saw Martin Sexton live.
Hmm.
And he's now become a good friend. You know, he's how I met my producer, Crit Harmon. Through being a Marty fan, I met Crit. But now Crit and I have done... three records together, but Martin Sexton's live show is like one of the best things I've ever seen. You know, it's like right up there with Bruce Springsteen's live show, I think. Transcendent. And so that made a huge impression when I was, but I was more like 16 then, so I'd say seeing Tracy and seeing Sean when I was young really hit me.
What about, I guess, well, we already talked about when you first performed live, it was the talent show.
Yeah, and then later it was like years of dive bars. In Pittsfield, like, Dart League night, you know, ducking the drunken construction workers playing darts. Like, it was not glamorous, but it was good practice.
Yeah.
And I tried to figure out how to hold my own.
What was the first show where you kind of felt like that, yes, this is really what I'm supposed to do?
What's funny is I thought it was what I was supposed to do even on Dart League night when all the crap was going on. I don't know why, but I was like, this is what I love, and I found a way to be oblivious to the other stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think what the first show that was like seated and everyone was paying attention. I used to play in this old club up in the mountains called the Old Egremont Club. It was near where I grew up. And I'd say like my CD release show there for my first studio record in like 1997 maybe.
Mm-hmm.
It was the first time where it was like full of people that were there to see me, and they were sitting and they were listening, and I was like, I'm having a real gig. This is amazing. Cool.
So what's next? So you've got Sean Colvin coming up that you're opening for.
Yeah, a little bit of a break. I mean, it's been a zoo this spring. May and June, I played the Pacific Northwest, and then I went straight to Dublin and played Ireland for a week, and then London, and then home, and then Colorado for 5 days. and then back to Boston for a festival. So I was, like, ready for a little break. But now, yeah, I do the Sean Colvin show, and then we just got into Lilith Fair with this this group, Winter Bloom, which is a collaboration group with a bunch of fellow women songwriters. And so we're all playing Lilith Fair Boston in July.
Cool.
Which is going to be huge.
It'll yeah, be that's going to be a big deal.
And then a bunch of shows in the Midwest, playing some festivals, and playing Michigan and Chicago and, you know, everywhere in between.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's quite a few shows in July.
Yeah, a lot coming up.
Yeah.
Was it different over in Europe? I mean, did you notice a different audience? I know here, what was interesting to me at the Rockwood, just coming from out west in San Diego. In San Diego, people talk through the whole show. And they just
really?
Do. Yeah, and it's, like, upsetting in a way. And then here, I noticed they had, like, a room for talking and a room for listening, which was awesome. So, did you notice something different over there with people, the audience? And
it totally depended on the venue. Like, there were some really good nights. This is my fourth time playing Ireland, so it all depends on who you're opening for and what the venue vibe is. You know, of course, it can be a drinking, loud pub scene, or it can be a totally seated. I feel like, you know, if it's the right artist that I'm supporting, the audience will be completely quiet and focused and then sing along whenever you ask them to, which is great. But it's like, you know, it's like here. It's hit or miss. It's either like a really rowdy scene or totally on moment.
And you just roll with it.
Yeah. Yeah, played some festivals there that were fun.
Cool. All right, well, thanks so much
for
taking the time.
Oh my God, thanks for helping me navigate the city. It was amazing. Thanks for you're definitely going to be my tour manager when I'm out west. So.
Yeah, it's fun. And I mean, New York City is such a magic place. So
yeah,
really appreciate it. So
it was a fun adventure.
Meg Hutchinson, for those of you who have a new iPhone, she has an iPhone app.
That's right. I take no responsibility for it, but I do choose the poems that go on there. So
that's great. And then, you know, just a website, which, go ahead and plug your website.
MegHutchinson.com.
And that's S-O-N.
S-O-N, yeah.
So just if anyone's trying to spell it and not on the website. But yeah, thanks a lot, Meg.
Cool,
appreciate
thanks.
It.
Great all talking right. to you.
Six letters formed into words for all of our joys and all of our sorrows. 26 reasons to sit here all day trying to hear what I want to say. Just a few octaves shake.